Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the hangover episode of Bootstrap Web, where Jordan is in the struggle.
How you feeling there, Jordan?
I'm doing all right. You know, I'm a grown-up. I'm at work. But one foot firmly in the struggle.
Yeah.
What's going on, Brian? How are you?
Pretty good, you know, still at it. Yeah, I'm balancing doing real work and working on the yard with these leaves because they just keep coming down and it's crazy around here. It's that's actually stressing me out. Like, I have all this work to do on Process Kit and on the business, and this is like the first year that we decided, like, yeah, we're going to take care of the yard ourselves instead of, you know, hire someone.
Right.
And man, it is so much work in the fall. it's just never ending.
Tough to automate.
Yeah, exactly. It feels good to get outside and I enjoy it, but I'm also like, oh shit, it's so much.
My personal stress right now is just Halloween with kids is just so much to deal with.
Yeah, that's coming up too. Crazy.
Today I'm like doing I don't even know what you call it, hosting or administering a game. My kid has like a, it's called Spookorama. at the local junior high school gym where they have like a gigantic game of musical chairs, which is genuinely a lot of fun. But they also have a bunch of games for like the little kids, and the parents volunteer to, you know, to what would you call that? Host the game? Administer? That sounds pretty technical. But anyway, I will be in my Harry Potter outfit.
Oh, there you go.
A ring toss or whatever they have me do.
You know, Halloween is not the same. I don't know about everyone else listening, but in Long Island in Rockville Center, it was just a shit show out there on Halloween.
It was like, dangerous, man.
It was dangerous. Like egg fights and shaving cream. Yeah. Oh, yes. Man, it was insane.
Always like the dreaded older kids. Yeah, it was. There was fear involved. There were police involved. The whole deal.
It was fun, but it was pretty crazy. You know, but like now, like I'm in this town in Connecticut where there is none of that. It is like kids don't even trick or treat really anymore. It's crazy. You know, it's
different thing.
In our town, they have this like trunk or treat where everybody brings their cars to this big field, and the kids, you know, for little kids, you walk them around and
yes.
I don't know.
The little kids in costumes is cute. Yeah. It's the older kids that you're like, come on, man, just give it a break.
Yep.
Anyway. All right. So what are we talking about today, Brian? We got some things to talk about.
What do we got? Yeah. So I'm pretty much focused on Process Kit. I'm building, I'm designing, I'm trying to keep the early access list active. I got some thoughts on that. And, you know, Audience Ops is still chugging along pretty steady. That's on my end. What about you?
So I want to talk a little bit about case study marketing. This thing just keeps working for us. So I feel like it's worth just diving into for a few minutes on how we're doing it. We just released our new website. Finally, I don't want to talk about how long it took or how long it was in the works, but it's out.
Because maybe I missed it. I was actually on your site like 2 days ago or yesterday.
Newcarthook.com. Check it out.
Oh, dude, this is totally different. Like you must have put this live like today, right? Or yesterday?
It was yesterday afternoon. Yep.
Wow. It's funny because I was just kind of looking at a bunch of different SaaS sites to get ideas on like how they're handling their marketing. I'm trying to do the very beginning planning of marketing for Process Kit, and yours was in the mix, and I was looking at it. I must have actually loaded your site like a couple hours before you put the new design live.
Yep, definitely. Our approach there is really just more information. It was relatively thin, and we're trying to just bulk it up and be able to link to different parts of the site to answer questions. It just provide a lot more information up front.
Looks like you have a lot of video on there.
Yeah, we're trying to do a lot of video. We got an explainer video, which I firmly expected to hate because I just don't like explainer videos very much.
Yeah, I never watch them.
Neither do I. But it's much easier to explain things visually for our product, as other products as well. And the company did a great job. I like our video. The script is good. The whole deal. It's 90 seconds.
What I like is what I think you're doing here is using individual videos to showcase individual features. Like if you scroll down on your page, I started to do that a bit with Ops Calendar, and I plan to do the same with Process Kit. Cause like, that's where the headline and the little bit of copy on the page doesn't give you nearly enough. Like that's where you want to highlight the benefit. But most people are like, all right, but how does it work? What does it look like? And to show a quick video, that's really helpful.
That's it. The whole concept of the site to begin with was show, don't tell. How do we just show more instead of writing things out? And then the About Us page is now updated, which is a trip. It's like you can see, you know, how many people. I think we had it with like four or five people for a really long time. We are actually moving offices next week. Both Portland team and Slovenia team are moving offices. We're going next week, and Slovenia is, I don't know, a month or two. But it is a trip. Like the office we got here in Portland, what we're laughing about is that we've outgrown it before we moved in.
Right.
Oops. But in Slovenia, we're trying not to make that mistake. So we're looking at offices for like 30 people, which is just a trip to wrap your mind around. Like, what's happening? And then the last thing we want to talk about is Tiny Seed. You know, Rob and Einar's new fund and that concept and the market and the gap it's filling. So I think that's just kind of cool for us to talk about. You're starting a new software company, right? I started bootstrapping, but then took on money. So it's like, it just feels very relevant.
Yeah. Oh, and the other thing that just occurred to me, I think it was, this happened since the last episode. I went to Cabo Press in Mexico, which was a ton of fun. Chris Lema puts on a really amazing trip. I think they've been doing it for like 5 years, but this was my first time down there at this like all-inclusive resort in Cabo. This year, there were about 30, 32 people there. A lot of WordPress product folks, some not, some service folks, some even like outside of the WordPress space. Yeah, just such a great time. I would love to go back if they'd have me. And then actually after that trip, I wrote an article about tiny conferences. And it's just a thing that I want to double down on. I want there to be more tiny conferences in the world. I want you people listening to organize your own and get together because they are amazing. Yeah.
I saw the article and I was really happy that you sat down and, you know, and wrote out what you guys have done with Tiny Snow.
I've been asked enough times by people about like, oh, how do I organize one of these? Or where can I find one like this? Or we have to turn away people with Big Snow because there's literally only like 10 spots in the house. And so I wanted to put together a page, like a resource where, all right, here's how we've done it. Here's what I get out of it. Here are some suggestions if you're going to organize your own. And then at the bottom, there is a list of the tiny conferences that I know of. And if you guys know of any, or if you're starting one up, shoot me the link and I'll just put it on there and just point people to it. So
yeah, I saw the article immediately get traction, start to get shared, people liking it. So it's definitely a thing we've talked about here in Portland, and I'm sure we'll do something. And we'll definitely look to that model.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, at this point, it's basically my mastermind group. I go to the Vermont trip, the Colorado trip. And with those guys, we have a Slack all year long and we kind of chat in there, and then we meet up, you know, once or twice a year. And it's awesome.
Cool. So what's happening with Process Kit?
So I'm hitting that challenging point that I think a lot of startups hit, right? Where you've presented the idea, you put up the landing page, you got a lot of people to sign up for the early access list. You've done customer research calls. I've done like 20 or 25 of them at this point. And I have them in a Facebook group and I have them in a Slack group. I talked about all that. And I've been sharing the designs, getting a lot of feedback through those groups. That's been awesome. Now the designs are mostly finished. I mean, I've mocked up the screens that I'm basically going to mock up. And now I have enough to go off of to now get into code and get this thing working in the browser, right? Since I got back from Cabo, which was about 2 weeks ago now, I've spent about the last 2 weeks coding every single day. I'm building the app in Rails using I'm basically learning as I go here. I've been learning Rails for most of this year, and I've been working with a coach on that, and that's been incredibly helpful too. But now I'm in that building phase, and I actually like cracked through a whole bunch of early features, like maybe 10% of the app in terms of the underlying functionality is built. So you can create an account, you can have multiple accounts, you can create projects, you can create processes and associate them and all this stuff. And so the challenge that I'm having now is that like what I'm working on is not super visual. It looks like garbage in the browser because I haven't applied the design to it yet. And it's not a fully usable app yet. And I'm trying to have something new to share with the early access people every week. I'm trying to do that work in public thing, but I'm hitting that lull where it's like everything was very active a couple of weeks ago where I was doing a lot of calls. I was doing designs. Hey, what do you think of this screenshot? What do you think of these concepts? You could look at them. You can talk about them, give me feedback. Today, I did record a video of of me walking through what I've built. And I was kind of undecided, like, should I even show this? Because it's so, so rough. Like, if you're not familiar with the software development process and you look at this, you're going to be like, what is that?
That's the assumption that's holding you back from sharing the ugly bits, the vulnerable bits.
Well, I'm going to share it. I recorded this video. I'm going to send it to the newsletter tomorrow. This was the first time that I'm about to share something where I'm really thinking twice about it. Like, would this do more harm than good to share this now? Because it is so rough.
Yeah.
You know, because they're just going to see like raw, like, text in a browser. And I'm trying to go back and forth between like what you see here will later on look more like this. But I think that's clear enough. I just wanted to show progress and also show people like what I've been able to build in Rails. I mean, I wasn't able to build anything close to this just a few months ago. So that's been kind of exciting.
I mean, that's, I think, a lot of what people want to see, but I don't know what your early access list is made up. Is it people interested in what you're doing and business side of things overall, or like really the solution itself? What it makes me think of is our buddy Justin Jackson isn't just building in public, he's learning in public. So he goes full authentic, full vulnerable. He's like, I don't know how to do this. People come on and show me what I'm doing wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in the same boat, right? I'm probably the most public right now that I've been, both on ProcessKit, but I've also been sending my newsletter to my larger list every week now, just behind the scenes, what I'm focused on, what I'm having trouble with. And so I get a lot of feedback through that. And there are a lot of developers, there are a lot of non-developers. But in the early access for ProcessKit, that group tends to be more a lot of client services folks who have like agencies and teams. And then there are some SaaS folks with teams. And if you're running a team, you probably need some processes. You're doing things repeatedly. You're onboarding customers, or you're hiring people, or you're churning out website projects or things like that. Those are the people who tend to, or you're doing marketing work like an audience ops, like a SEO or a PPC firm or something like that. Those are the people who tend to resonate with it. But so I'm in that mix where it's like I'm kind of building and designing, but I'm also, I want to keep those people engaged somehow. And the challenging part of it is that like I know, like, we all make the classic mistake of like you build and you think about marketing later, right? I'm trying to avoid that. I'm trying to get some sort of wheels turning on marketing for ProcessKit. Like, I've done the community marketing a little bit, but I've been putting together ideas for like a podcast or some sort of like free resource that would make sense for this audience to tie in with ProcessKit. And first of all, I'm a solo founder, so just hours in the day is a big challenge. I do have a lot of free time on my hands. Like, Audience Ops is basically just running with the team. So I'm working on ProcessKit like full time every day, even with like 5 full days a week. Even if I say something like, okay, 3 days will be on product and 2 days will be on marketing, it is not that easy in reality, because it's like...
And development work requires getting into it mentally. You can't just hop in and out.
I can't split a single day between the two, but even a whole week, it's a totally different mindset to work on marketing work versus product work, whether it's design or development. Like, I'm in the zone, I'm in creation mode, I'm in technical mode. But then with marketing, I got to think about like writing and audience and funnels, analytics. Like, there it's just a totally different work.
Maybe you need longer sprints than 1 day. Right now you're looking at it as a week. Maybe you should be looking at it as a month and say, I'll do 3 weeks of development and 1 full week of marketing. Just more extended time thinking about the same things. I mean, at least that could be a wrinkle to try.
That is what I've been thinking. But then it's like, okay, it's that chicken or egg. That's okay. So if I focus only on marketing for a month, that means the product stands still, and that delays getting the product into the hands of customers. If I hustle on the product, then the marketing gets a little bit pushed off. So it's that challenge, and that's really where a team or a partner or a co-founder would really come in handy. And I've talked a bit about this. I was on the Art of Product podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I think I mentioned here, I've been talking to a few folks about potentially, you know, working with a technical partner, somebody to come in and basically take over the technical side, like redo whatever I've built so far. And and I'd focus on the design, the front end, and the marketing stuff. And it's like I'm kind of doing this like parallel path now, right? Like
it's a lot to do. It's a lot to do both.
Well, I mean, what I mean is I'm going in parallel paths where it's like I am talking to a few different people, about potentially working together on Process Kit, but I don't know if or when any of those things might pan out. And so I'm also spending all my time just building it, assuming that I'm going solo.
You know? Yes. That sounds like the reasonable approach to it. Don't wait to find someone before making progress. The more progress, the better, always. But it is a difficult split. The way we've been talking about it internally is offense versus defense. And I feel like we've been playing defense for a really, really long time because we have a pretty strong inbound engine at this point. And we just get signups and we can count on it. It's consistent. It feels like our planning, our work, and our hiring has been defensive, right? How do we handle that incoming demand, just the inbound? Now I'm starting to talk about, okay, when do we go on offense? When do we go and try to double the number of leads that are coming in? Right, because up until now, so it sounds a bit like you were like, almost, it's almost like the development is a bit defensive and marketing is offensive. And it's really hard to do both if you're one person. It's really hard to do both even with a company of 15.
But in the early stage, the product is also marketing, right?
Yeah,
that's right. Like the sooner we can get the product out, the sooner we can get it into the hands of beta users and customers and all that. And anything else that takes us away from us, like it's me, you know, but anything else that pulls me away from that daily ship features into the app, like delays that date of getting it into the hands of customers. So it's
right. The initial step, right? The initial invasion.
Again, it's like, you know, I'm just going in circles here, but it's like still on my mind, like all those days of working on the product mean, hey, I'm not talking to customers. And like, I'm in that lull where like they're not hearing about it much and you don't want to go too long with being too quiet. So we'll see.
That's a challenge.
Yep. Why don't you tell us about this inbound engine that's working?
Yeah. So the reason the most effective strategy that's worked for us to get the inbound coming in, right? Again, we are not in the Shopify App Store, so we have to go and create demand. What's been working for us is really similar to what we talked about what I talked about on stage at MicroConf, that use paid advertising to promote content so that the first interaction with your brand and your company is free content. And then that builds a retargeting audience. And then you make the free trial offers through ads only to the retargeting audience, not the cold audience. So it's basically that, but it specifically works with case studies. It's just an effective way to prove that what you're selling is good. And it is more closely related to the product than other content that is tangential or adjacent, but not about your product.
So you're running the cold ads to the case study. Are they articles? Are they videos? Or
we do a whole bunch of stuff. So we work with a really great company that is run by a microconfer, Joel Kettle. He runs a company called Case Study Buddy. And these guys are pros. It's a productized service for case studies, and they're really good at it, right? It is not cheap, but you get quality for what you pay for. And then what we do is we take that and we extend that value as far as possible. So we take the case study, we have a larger, like a longer version of the full case study, then we have like a 2-page version of the case study, then we put that on the web as well, and we just use it all over the place. So it starts off with cold ads to the case study, and then you opt in and get the full length case study. Then you're on a retargeting list, and that's when we start messaging you, and that's also when you get on drip, and then we're starting to tie that into right message to start to know, hey, this person downloaded this case study, let's offer them a different case study when they come to the site, that type of stuff. And then the retargeting list is what drives all those free trials. And then we take it and then we put it on the site to get SEO out of it. And then we start linking to it and it links to other case studies, so even more SEO. And then we rotate it in as the exit intent pop-up and on the right bar from right message. So it's like we just get as much value as possible out of this case study. The great thing is
how often are you coming out with new case studies?
Every 6 weeks or so. We're promoting like every 2 months. And what Case Study Buddy does is it allows us to be offensive without hiring, right? Ed and I, our marketer, we just look at each other and say, okay, cool. We want to do, you know, this number of case studies over the next 6 months. And then we reach out to customers, and then you just link the customer to the people at Case Study Buddy. And that's it. They do the interview, they do the copy, they get approval, they do the design, publish the whole deal. So it allows it to just basically just take money and be like, let's just have a case study. Here you go, and get a case study back.
That's something that like we've done quite a bit at Audience Ops for clients. We do case study articles and we interview their customers all the time and things. And that's something that I've really done a bad job of like promoting that. Cause I talk about it on sales calls at Audience Ops, and it goes over really well. And a lot of our clients have us do it, but I don't like even promote it on the website for whatever stupid reason. But
yeah, I feel like that could be an add-on service. Because it's great. It's crazy valuable. I'll show you one. It's beautifully done. And then it has that benefit of being free content that is directly adjacent to what we're selling, right? It basically just highlights, like our latest one is with a company called BombTech. So that launches today. So BombTech Golf, cool company. Actually, the funny coincidence, BombTech Golf was the number one first customer for CardHook 5 years
really?
Ago.
Oh, that's yep. great.
I was sending cold email to Volusion merchants, and this guy Sully, who runs BombTech, responded, got on the phone. He asked me questions I had no answers for, and he was like, "This is just cool. Let's just do this. Just make this happen, Jordan. I'll be your first customer."
That's awesome, so man.
He's done really well for himself and is now running this golf brand. I don't know who has the balls to run a golf brand, but it's like successful. And he came in and he did $100,000 in a day on CardHook. So we were like, Sully, we need to bring this full circle. We need a case study to highlight you on the site. Come on.
And so like these case studies, like if you're running cold traffic to it through ads and whatnot, like it's not about CardHook. It's about this story of some e-commerce owner to bring them into the funnel, that it reduces that friction of clicking on an ad if it's just a story about someone like you, right?
Yep, that's right. It's about them, and our product is talked about in the context of what the merchant was trying to accomplish and how they used CardHook to accomplish it. That's how you want your potential customers to envision your product. I have problems, I have wants, I have needs, and this is how I can use these individual features that I don't care about the feature, I care about that it allows me to accomplish what I want to accomplish.
Love it.
Yep.
You know, I put this question out on Twitter yesterday, because again, this week I've been not doing a lot of work on this yet, but I'm thinking about like, what will the marketing for Process Kit look like? Should I do a podcast? Should I do blog content? Should I do some sort of like course? Or what I asked on Twitter was, what makes a company like worthy of following? We follow people, we follow personal brands sometimes, like, you know, we want to see what so-and-so is up to. But like, if you think about it, like, what are the brands, what are the product companies that you're just always tuned into for whatever reason?
When they come out with something, you pay attention.
So when they come out with something, like you want to know all about it, you know?
Right.
What are they doing that makes their stuff so interesting and so like follow worthy? And I'm trying to figure that out. And like, you know, a lot of common names come to mind, like people follow along with Basecamp and Stripe and, I mean, Apple and Tesla and, you know, all sorts of different brands. And I can name a bunch that I just happen to tune into, but there are a bunch of products that I pay for, like SaaS products, and a bunch of them, like I don't follow their stuff, but I do pay for them. I use their tool. It's great. But then there are other products that I'm actively following. And sometimes I'm not necessarily a customer, but I have considered it, but I still follow everything that they're doing. And I talk about them a lot.
Yeah. It has your attention.
Has my attention. So it's like, what can you do to stand out today? Like it's, you know, there's a lot of like tried and true things that seem to get pretty noisy. And I'm trying to figure out like, how could it be different?
Yeah. Quality. I assume you're looking at this as a situation where you're not going to do everything. Right? You're not going to blog and podcast and do videos and everything. So you kind of have to choose what's your angle.
One thought is to start it as a podcast where it's like, I'll do the podcast, but then we can repurpose those interviews in different ways. You know, Nathan Barry just had a pretty good article about that. It's like, use the podcast as like the seed of ideas that you can then build into additional like unique content. But
yeah, that was an interesting article. And Nathan's one of those people that you do pay attention to. And it's a combination. It's a combination of, you know, behind it is real results. And so that gives it weight, a bit like Basecamp, a bit like Tesla, a bit like Apple, like, you know, behind it, that it's not like a BS product. So you do give them more credibility. It seems like, if I think about something like Stripe, it feels like they come out with high quality things less often. So when it comes out, you say, all right, I'll give it my attention.
I think that like some of these products like Stripe and Tesla and I guess Apple, like their products are so innovative, but also so broadly usable and interesting. Like they solve a really big problem that a lot of people have, and they do it in some innovative new way that like people just have to talk about them. And not all SaaS products are like that. I mean, if I think about ProcessKit, yeah, I think we're doing it in a sort of new way, but it's not like a groundbreaking sort of innovation, you know?
Yes, but you can still command attention if you do things properly. I think authenticity is the really hard thing to create or to copy or mimic, and people see right through things these days, which is why, like, the example that comes to mind is Cardi B. Okay, I don't really listen to her or know her, but I know that that's why people really like her, because she's super authentic to the point of like, I would never talk about that, but she does, and so people follow it. If you think, there are some people in the software world, we talked about Justin Jackson, that authenticity.
Yeah, I think it comes down to like super innovative, big problem product, or really interesting, like founders who are talking about the things that are interesting to their target customers, right? Like, yeah, like Justin Jackson is a great example. Josh Pickford, the things that he tends to talk about on podcasts or on Twitter or whatever, like, are interesting to people who run SaaS companies who would probably use Baremetrics.
That's right. So there's a nice fit there. I mean, look, if we're starting to go down this road, right? Let's admit you have a lot to say about systems and process. That is authentic. You talking about how to set things up to run automated businesses that you've done, you know, multiple times, that's authentic to talk about. Now, what format that takes, if it's you talking to a microphone or you talking to other like systems leaders, I don't know what format that comes into.
So what I've already been talking to this early access group is about, like, part of the survey was, what are the most common repeatable processes in your business? And I have a list of about 8 to 10 that like almost every one of these companies has. Like, we do new client onboarding, we do new employee onboarding, we do website deliverables, we do marketing deliverables. And so if I can have some sort of like big resource broken down into like 8 parts, the ultimate guide to client onboarding. And it features interviews with a few companies and how they do onboarding, and a process template that you can plug right into ProcessKit for how to do your client onboarding and get that up and running, you know, and a mix of like video interviews and text, and just make it like an 8-part or like a 10-part, I don't want to call it a blog, but like a
resource post.
Like a resource, you know. Mm-hmm.
Now, I think you can take that and extend it directly into the product. So what I mean by that is, let's say you talk to, I don't know your company, you know that company from Claire Liu.
Yep.
You talk to Know Your Company about how to do new hire onboarding. And then what you can do is take the Know Your Company onboarding process and have that as a template inside there. So it's like, you see this content, if you buy into it, you can have access to it inside the product. It's what Lead Pages did well with, here's a template, here's how to use it. You can download it yourself, or you can do it more easily in our tool. It was like a really nice cohesion.
Yeah, that is kind of what I'm thinking for this is to have these process or workflow templates ready to go. Just create your ProcessKit account and it's in your account, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And being opinionated seems to work. I don't like people telling me what to do on Twitter, but it works, right? When people are like, this is how you should do something. I'm, you know, my tendency is to be like, screw you, but it does work. I mean, they've repelled me, but they're attracting others.
In the way that I'm thinking about this tool and how I'm designing it is I want it to be opinionated a little bit. Like, that's kind of one of my big problems with a lot of what we'll be competing against, these project management tools where it's like you can go in there and you can do 1,000 different things in 1,000 different ways.
Not helpful.
It's not super helpful. So this is like, if you're onboarding a lot of clients, here's a good process for that. And here's how we recommend you do it. You could use our process. You could build on top of it. You could adapt it. You could create your own. But like we recommend these best practices for setting up a workflow in this way, setting up these automation rules in this way. Like, I actually think that a lot of the like the email automation tools and also Zapier, like they're great and I heavily use them, but it took years for me to really figure out like what's the best way to actually set up this workflow. And I feel like they haven't fully like taught me what I need to learn about that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We get the same sense from our customers. They just want to know what works. That's it. And we hear a lot of, I wish I could have, let's say, this page just like this company I admire. We are working on coming out with like, here's the Bonobos checkout page, right? Basically get your checkout page to be just like Bonobos, or here's the Casper mattress landing page. Because people look at what they admire, they want to accomplish it. They don't know how to go from where they are right now to having that.
Yeah. Yep. Love it.
Cool, man. Cool. I like it.
So what are we talking about with Tiny Seed? This is pretty exciting from Rob.
Very, very interesting stuff happening. Very exciting. We've talked about just financing and bootstrapping and like what's happening and where's the gap between bootstrapping and institutional investors. We've been talking about that for a while. And now we have, right, the grand poobah of bootstrapping coming out with a fund. It's like, that's a way to shake it up right there. It's not just somebody from the community. It's the leadership of the community. And that's just really, you can't ignore that. So I think everyone's going to take a look at it. Everyone's going to be super curious about the terms and the approach. I have a lot of opinions on this. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, what stuck out to me, you know, because obviously Rob has been talking about the idea of fund strapping for a while. And a few months ago, you know, you hear him kind of mention he's thinking about it more on the podcast. It's like, okay, he's putting something together here, you know. What was interesting when he kind of, is it tinyseed.com or .?
I'll take a look now. I think we'll get it linked up
in the show notes. What stuck out to me was that like, okay, so we've seen Indie VC and we've seen that model a little bit. And we know people like you, like Cardhook and a couple other, you know, companies that we know who've taken this sort of like fund strapping round to get to profitability and all that. But what was interesting about Tiny Seed is how much they're branding it or positioning it for bootstrappers. Like they're using the term bootstrapping pretty heavily in their landing page. That kind of stuck out to me. I don't know of any other funds or accelerators that really focus in on that as like a target market, you know?
Well, that's the whole thing. It's been assumed for a long time that there's no market there. That people either want to take money or they don't. And what we've talked about is the fact that there's a whole bunch of different shades of gray in between. And I think they say it on the page themselves. They basically just want to see, the hypothesis is what happens when a bootstrapper, someone who thinks about profitability and sustainability in the business, what happens when you give that person a little bit of breathing room? A little bit of, why don't you take a year and focus on it as opposed to trying to juggle everything? Or if you're already focused on it, it's already making money and it's covering your expenses, what would you do if you had a little bit more buffer? What would you do if you had more room? What would you do if you have more mentorship and formality to the process? Now, the part that I am really curious to see how things unfold, and I told Rob from the beginning, as soon as it came out, I was like, I want to be involved somehow or another. If you need mentors, if you need something, I just really want to be involved in that. The interesting thing is a fund is probably not going to make financial sense without acquisitions. Now, I think is where you get to a slightly awkward position where you're looking for people who are bootstrapped, and one of the things about institutional money is that they expect an outcome. They expect a liquidity event, an acquisition or going public, which does not happen very often these days. So the acquisition is almost the goal. And so How does that work? How does that line up?
Where how do you work the model where they can basically make this a business off of the dividends off of a profitable company? Like,
I think it ends up in acquisitions. I think that's the only way a fund works. So is there an audience mismatch? I don't think there is. I think underneath the surface, 95% of bootstrappers in their heart of hearts want to get fucking rich, and they see an acquisition as the best path.
Bootstrapping is not anti-selling your business.
Yes, but the sustainability seems to be part of the religion. The fact that you want to build a profitable business for the long run, where in reality, almost everyone would be like, what's that? Millions of dollars in my bank account? Awesome. I will say yes to an acquisition. So now, as Tiny Seed, the marketing for that kind of fund is super tricky, because you're like, in order for it to make financial sense, you need acquisitions to happen. But you also can't put that out into the bootstrapping community as like, we'll help you get acquired, right? That's not going to work.
See, I think what you're hitting on there, and I think what Rob and by the way, of course, our friend Einar Volset is the co-founder of this as well.
TinySeedFund.com.
TinySeedFund.com, of course. So what I think you're hitting on here, and I think what a lot of people incorrectly connect, is the idea of bootstrapping with a lifestyle business. Not all bootstrappers want to do a lifestyle business. And I think actually most bootstrappers aren't going for a lifestyle business. Like, if you are, then that's the sort of thing like you want to just have enough to pay for your lifestyle. But I think what most of us who are bootstrapping are thinking about is, how can I make this profitable so that I can live comfortably now, but I do want to work on my business every single day, and I want to grow it into a valuable asset. I'm not looking to just pay my low cost of living.
Right. Like, and you want to have the option to sell if you want to.
Yeah, of course. Yep. And I think plenty of bootstrappers think in terms of like selling. I mean, I've been every few years I've been thinking about like, all right, well, what's next? Like this isn't my forever company. I don't really think in terms of forever companies anymore. I think most entrepreneurs don't. I mean, the idea that Jason Fried and DHH have worked on Basecamp for this many years is, I mean, that is one of the most unique things about that company. Like the
longevity.
Not many people stick with a single product or a single, you know, business for that many years. You know,
people switch jobs and entrepreneurs switch companies. You know, at some point you might just get tired of being the card hook guy. You know, after 10 years or something, okay, you might just want to move on. And what did not exist even 5 years ago is the capital markets to support it. The actual interest to acquire companies at the $5 to $20 million range didn't really exist a few years ago, not to the same degree as now. And now, you know, we're not that big, but private equity companies email me every other week. And it's this search for opportunities. So even private equity companies are reaching down and starting to talk to entrepreneurs earlier on in the process. So it's not like that card hook is special. My guess is any software company out there that's hit $1 million in ARR and more are getting the same exact emails from the same analysts at the same firms. And a lot of those conversations with PE companies has been, well, we are acquiring 10 to 20 companies over the next year, and we're putting together this group of companies that we then want to sell off. Like, that's the private equity approach. So for them to acquire companies in that $2, $5, $8, $10 million range, they literally do that all day. I met with someone 2 days ago from a private equity company, and they were doing 40 acquisitions over a 2-year period. The fund was 6 months old, and they had already done 9 acquisitions. So that part of the market is all of a sudden opened up.
There's a ton of activity there.
That's actually the thing. If Tiny Seed and our community can match with that capital markets demand, because the problem when you raise a $10 million round from institutional investors, you can't sell for $10 million. You have to sell for 100. But if you raise 100, 200, 300K, you can sell for $3 million and everyone's happy.
Yep. And there's still that gap to go from zero to be playing in that game where you could have something and build something of value in that market. Because like, I think what Rob and Einar are hitting on here is, if you have a full-time job, or if you've been consulting, you're probably looking to get into the product. You have some product that you've been hacking away on nights and weekends, maybe putting some of your, if you're an agency, putting some of your developer hours on the little product, but most of your income comes from client work. To really go full time and make a lot of progress fast. When I was doing Restaurant Engine, I didn't get to work on Restaurant Engine full time until somewhere in like the 2.5 to 3 year mark of that business. Like if you're in this bootstrapping, a lot of people in that space are, it's like their first business so that they can stair step to something next. And that doesn't necessarily mean to stair step to a VC business next, but it means you're well positioned to start up something even faster the next time if you've had an exit on the first time, or if you've built something that can run automatically and throw off cash. And the only way to even start something like that and get into that game is to have the time to pay for your own time or your co-founder's time. And I think that's where something like Tiny Seed really, really comes in, because I talked to so many people and I was totally in this myself with Restaurant Engine. And then going into Audience Ops, I had a little bit of a cushion and I was able to build Audience Ops into a point where it's really, you know, paying for my time. Like, there aren't that many options to be able to do that.
Yep. You know? Can't take out a loan, and the institutional thing is not open to everyone. And your business might not make sense for giant swing for the fence home runs scenario that it doesn't need to be these days, which is why. Yeah.
And I've been teaching, you know, consultants about the productized services for years. And for me, that's been the path that has worked really well. But that clearly is not for everyone. Like, not everybody wants to build a service team and build a whole team with systems and processes. Like, some people do, but there are plenty of people who just want to go straight to their SaaS product idea. And there's really nothing wrong with that, but you have to have a viable way to actually do it. And I guess with Tiny Seed, it's not just the capital to pay for that year of runway. It's the mentorship, right? It's the network. So it's really like a true accelerator. It's not just a fund, but it's an accelerator.
Yeah, I think it has the potential to be, you know, YC in this new segment of the market. And by far the biggest factor is not the money. It is the deal flow that fund will see. When that comes out and applications open up or something in January, I think the number and quality of applicants is just going to be so much better than any. If I just raised my hand right now and said, I'm starting a fund, I have $2 million to invest, I want to put in 100K each for 20 companies, I just wouldn't get the number of applicants and the quality of applicants that they're going to get because of Rob's involvement. So that's what I think gives it the best possible chance. I think it's great for everyone if Tiny Seed Fund 1, that it succeeds. Because if it succeeds, more will sprout up. Like, look, there are plenty of people out there with $2 million. It's just that the capital these days is relatively cheap and the time is even more expensive than ever. So if Tiny Seed Fund 1 comes out there, invests in 10, 15 companies and gets two or three winners, maybe one home run that sells for 40 million and a few others that sell for, you know, that 5 to 10 range, all of a sudden everyone's going to say, look, this works. You can take a few $1 million and turn it into tens of millions with investing in this space. And then that'll start to proliferate. And then there'll be more competition among investors for entrepreneurs. And then people will have a new option to get funded, give themselves space, work on product, but not have to swing for a $100 million exit.
I think we're all kind of sitting here waiting to hear, you know, more of the details. And what I'm also interested in is like the structure of it, because it's an accelerator. I think they're all remote. So you're talking to mentors or some sort of like weekly or some sort of sessions that you're getting with the mentors. Like, what else is involved there? You know, it'll be pretty cool to hear. Maybe we'll have to see if Rob wants to come on here and tell us more.
Yeah, Rob, if you're listening, you have to come on. Maybe we can have him and Einar on. Yeah, yep. I think when they come out with the terms is when we'll have more of that conversation, right? There's IndieVC. You can see their terms. They're public. Rand Fishkin, when he raised money for his new company, open sourced their terms and explained and wrote a blog post explaining why the terms are what they are and the reason they structured it that way.
Yeah, I'd also be interested to hear what their criteria is, if they have some sort of like thesis or some sort of focus. you know, bootstrappers is a little bit broad, right? Like, is it SaaS only? Is it a certain sectors? Is it like, what do they look for in teams and all that? So I'm curious to hear all that.
Yep. All right, man, I am off to have one last lunch at this Thai place that I go to 5 days a week, more or less, before we move offices to the east side, where we are two blocks away from my favorite Thai place, the place we went to.
Oh, okay. Very cool.
Yep.
I'll have to come out again and visit the new office.
Maybe when we have a tiny conf here, you should come out.
Whoa, I'll be there.
Oh, there we go.
It's coming full circle.
All right. We'll see. Hopefully this helps my hangover.
All right, dude. Good. Have a good one.
Good talking, man.
I'm going to go out there and rake some leaves.
See ya.